Tracy. The film begins with the two legendary actors playing partners in a wildcat oil company. They eventually split and become fierce competitors, the fortunes of each rising and falling throughout the movie. Near the end of the film, Gable's character has worked a deal to slow down production, which threatens to put Tracy's character out of business. The federal regulators try to prosecute Gable's character for restraint of trade and call Tracy's character as a witness. Rather than seek protection from competition from the government, here is what Tracy's character says on the stand. He wanted these guys to produce less oil, so that their wells would flow years longer and not ruin the field. That way they'd get all the oil there was to get out of the wells. Don't you get the idea? He was for conservation. Now how could a guy be breaking the law when he's trying to save the natural resources of the country? Now he didn't know he was doing anything that you might call noble, but being one of the best oil men there is, he's got the right hunch about oil. Wow. When was the last time you heard an argument for the free market like that in a Hollywood picture? With just a few sentences, he blows up the entire liberal complaint against free markets. Liberals constantly talk about markets as if there is an inherent conflict between individuals pursuing profits and the greater good of society. There isn't. Just like Spencer Tracy said, entrepreneurs pursuing profits benefit society at the same time. In fact, they benefit society because they are pursuing profits. Entrepreneurs also protect the environment more than will a million government employees with a trillion of your tax dollars. By trying to maximize revenues and minimize costs, they naturally conserve resources. Raw materials cost money. An entrepreneur seeks to get every bit of value possible out of every yard, pound, or fluid ounce of raw materials, because the more value they provide for any given cost, the more profits they make. There is no conflict between profits and the environment. Let me share one more jewel from this diamond mine of real American culture. After Tracy teaches the judge and the movie audience that capitalism is good for the environment, he asks a question we all should be asking ourselves now. So now I'm wondering, is it getting to be out of line for a man like him to make $1 million with his brains and with his hands? Because if that's true, we'd better rewrite this land of opportunity stuff. That's what Obama and the progressive left want to do. Rewrite this land of opportunity stuff. Instead of people feeling inspired by entrepreneurs who made $1 million with their brains and their hands, they want people to feel aggrieved and envious. They want them to resent businessmen who offer them jobs and opportunity, and revere the government that offers them handouts. Men weren't the only heroes during Hollywood's golden age. Another of my favorites from this period was Mildred Pierce, starring Joan Crawford. The main plot is about Mildred Pierce's devotion to a daughter who is wholly unworthy of it, and eventually betrays her mother and commits a murder. But what I love most about this film is the way heroism is portrayed. When Mildred Pierce's unfaithful husband leaves her, she doesn't complain about a war on women or look for a government handout. She starts by baking cakes in her kitchen, which grows into a baking business, which she then grows into a successful chain of restaurants. She wins her own independence through hard work and making the most of the opportunities a free market offers her. She is heroic because she is a successful entrepreneur. She is self-reliant and successful, but there is no implication that she becomes so at the price of her ethics or morality. On the contrary, her sound moral character is one of the reasons for her success, as it is for most entrepreneurs in the real world. The film is prescient in one way. The contrast between the faithful, hard-working Mildred Pierce and her snotty, entitled, greedy daughter is a perfect metaphor for the contrast between the greatest generation and the baby boomers. The former defeated two tyrannical empires and built the most prosperous economy in world history. The latter set out to destroy everything their parents built and create an amoral, godless, socialist sewer. You might be wondering how things could have changed so much in Hollywood. How could the same town that produced Sands of Iwo Jima, Boomtown, and Mildred Pierce become so uniformly leftist? What happened to the opposition party in Hollywood? You may as well ask why there are so few climate scientists who challenge the global warming hoax in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. The answer is the same for both questions. Anyone who dissented was purged through propaganda and character assassination. The false history of the McCarthy era. Unless you were born yesterday or have been living under a rock, you probably have some knowledge of what is now called McCarthyism. While most people don't know all the details, most are aware that for a period during the late 1940s and 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin headed the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC. As head of the committee, McCarthy accused many members of the U.S. State Department and other departments within the government of being communist spies or communist sympathizers. He and the HUAC also blacklisted a number of Hollywood movie producers, directors, scriptwriters, and actors because of their alleged communist affiliations. If you know all of the above, I have news for you. You've fallen prey to yet another progressive mind trick. You've swallowed another liberal fairy tale, hook, line, and sinker. This particular lie isn't even internally consistent. First, Senator Joseph McCarthy couldn't have had anything to do with the House Un-American Activities Committee. McCarthy was never elected to the House of Representatives. He was a U.S. senator. He chaired the Senate Committee on Government Operations, but the House Un-American Activities Committee had existed for over a decade before McCarthy's campaign against communism. More importantly, the HUAC did not blacklist anyone from working in Hollywood. That wasn't a power any congressional committee had, then or now. The committee had the power to investigate subversive activities that threatened the form of government prescribed in the U.S. Constitution and to bring charges of real crimes, like espionage, when probable cause was established. The committee subpoenaed various Hollywood figures to appear for questioning. When some of them refused to answer, they were charged with contempt of Congress, a misdemeanor. In response to the charges, the Motion Picture Association of America, a voluntary association of private individuals, issued a statement indicating they would no longer employ those people charged with contempt by Congress. The infamous blacklist was not affected by Senator McCarthy and was only indirectly related to the HUAC. It was really just private individuals within Hollywood exercising what used to be recognized as an inherent inalienable right, the right to associate or not associate with anyone you pleased. These Hollywood employers did not want the powerful influence of their studios used to promote communism and subvert the U.S. Constitution. In the years that followed, many more people were blacklisted. I'm sure that some were wrongly accused. Senator McCarthy became a symbol of the supposed witch hunt nature of the investigations, even after Alger Hiss was found guilty of perjury for denying his involvement in Soviet espionage. McCarthy had some personal foibles, alcoholism possibly being one of them. He was eventually censured by Congress after the same kind of multimedia total war-style character assassination that liberals have used on so many others who have opposed their agenda. What the progressive jackals have been successful in erasing from America's collective memory is the one most important fact. McCarthy was right. For the most part, his allegations were justified, as were the suspicions of those on the HUAC who subpoenaed the actors and screenwriters. We know this because of another bit of conveniently forgotten history called the Venona Project. Venona was a counterintelligence program run from 1943 through 1980 that decrypted Soviet intelligence communications. From the decrypted messages, U.S. intelligence was able to identify the Rosenbergs, Alger Hiss, Klaus Fuchs, and many others as Soviet spies in regular communication with the KGB. Hollywood producer Stephen Laird, who is also a reporter for Time magazine and CBS, was also identified. Hundreds of other people are mentioned in the decrypted messages, many of whom are also justifiably suspected of having been working with the Soviets during this period. Despite this hard evidence that his allegations of communist infiltration into government, media, and entertainment were generally true, McCarthy remains a poster child for right-wing paranoia. Just like a suspect in a crime whose indictment is reported on page one of the newspaper, but whose acquittal is reported on page 57, or not at all, no one remembers McCarthy's vindication due to these decoded messages. So effective was the vilification of McCarthy, the HUAC, and the private individuals who decided not to employ communists, that a complete reversal in Hollywood occurred. It became politically incorrect to voice any opposition to communism at all, just as it is political suicide to express any concern over radical Islam today. McCarthyism and Reds under the bed became in vogue witticisms to imply paranoia in anyone who expressed a concern about communism, even though many of those concerns were justified. Today, Islamophobia is used in the same way to vilify anyone who might express some concern about a well-equipped army of 9th century throwbacks who are rapidly conquering territory in the Middle East and establishing a brutal, murderous theocracy. Suggest that this has something to do with Islam itself, and you are set upon by the liberal jackals in much the same way McCarthy was all those years ago. But all of their propaganda doesn't change the truth. Rotten role models. Athletes, musicians, and other entertainers have even more influence on young people than movie stars. Unfortunately, that influence is almost universally bad. When kids aren't being bombarded with song lyrics and commentary by musicians pushing the leftist worldview, they're watching their idols in professional sports, committing crimes, and generally acting like thugs. In April, Time magazine released its list of the 100 most influential people. Topping the list was a talentless hack married to an exhibitionist wife whose chief claim to fame is an overly large behind. He will be largely remembered himself for rude, inexcusable behavior during two Grammy Awards ceremonies where he interrupted acceptance speeches to voice his opinion that the winner didn't deserve the award. Every boxer, regardless of skin color, goes on and on like Muhammad Ali. Apparently unaware, Ali did it tongue-in-cheek to promote his fights. What does it tell 9, 10, and 11-year-old boys who idolize these athletes when they exhibit no humility in victory or grace in defeat? The bad examples set for our children by athletes and entertainers don't stop at rudeness or poor sportsmanship. Violent crimes, including murder, sexual assault, and other offenses, continue to plague professional sports and entertainment. One NFL player was convicted of murder in April of this year, while another made headlines for viciously assaulting his girlfriend in an elevator. Young girls have similarly poor role models. If they learn anything from pop music stars, it's that dressing and dancing like a stripper is empowering. Madonna's antics a few decades ago seem tame now compared to the virtual pornography of the average music video. Even parents seem unconcerned when watching pre-teenage girls performing highly suggestive dance routines. The internet is flooded with videos of 8- and 10-year-old children mimicking sexual intercourse. I'm not blaming the kids for this. They don't know any better. It's a depraved culture that bombards them with sexual images and references in all media. A culture of envy. Picking up right where our current leader will leave off, Hillary Clinton is on the campaign trail inciting class warfare over income inequality. In a desperate attempt to ward off any possible challenges from even more radical socialists, Clinton actually vowed to topple the 1% at a press conference earlier this year. It's hard to believe Clinton has the nerve to say this, being a government-subsidized member of the 1% herself. Her husband is not only the wealthiest former U.S. president alive, but with a net worth of $55 million, he's among the 10 wealthiest of all time. Now that we know her and Bill's charity fund contributes very little to charity compared to what it takes in, it's even more hypocritical for her to criticize legitimate businesses who provide valuable products to people who know what they're purchasing when they hand over their money. According to the New York Post, the so-called charity took in more than $140 million in grants and pledges in 2013, but spent just $9 million on direct aid. Hillary doesn't see anything wrong with living lavishly off the public. She believes she's provided invaluable service that we should all be eternally grateful for. Never mind that most of her service was completely disastrous, like the Arab Spring she engineered as Secretary of State and the reset of relations with Russia she was supposed to lead. While Hollywood peddles the corporations kill people storyline, progressive politicians and media push another whopper. Rich people don't pay taxes. Where does the government get the money to provide the services it provides, however incompetently? Liberals don't ever seem to know the answer to this question. Contrary to what you might read in the New York Times, most of the money comes from those evil, greedy, rich people. The truth is, rich people pay most of the taxes in this country. 55% of all income taxes are paid by individuals who earn over $200,000 per year. 78% of all income taxes are paid by individuals who earn over $100,000 per year. Yet all we hear is, the rich don't pay their fair share. 78% seems more than fair, doesn't it? You would think, when listening to the Marxist-in-Chief or his accidental speechwriter, Elizabeth Warren, that upper-income Americans are somehow finagling out of paying any taxes at all. That's all part of the progressive narrative, along with phony American history and moronic economic theories. It's part of their all-out attack on American culture, specifically, in this case, the Protestant work ethic and the deeply held beliefs in private property, free enterprise, and self-reliance. These have all been bedrock American principles since the Pilgrims rejected socialist principles in the 1620s. These values grew out of America's Western European Judeo-Christian heritage. That's one reason white people and religion are demonized. American culture must be ripped out by the roots. They want to transform American culture into belief in socialism, central planning, and dependency. Inciting racial tension through demonization of successful white people helps accomplish that. Self-loathing liberals want to transform America into a self-loathing, guilt-ridden atheist culture they can wallow in, with a tax-subsidized life of luxury to help ease their pain. It is crony capitalism and luxury for them, socialism and misery for everyone else. Hillary Clinton is their perfect spokeswoman, a fabulously wealthy Gulf Stream liberal who condemns other wealthy people who actually earned their money. She and the Progressive Islamist Alliance are waging war on our culture in every medium they can, including public school, movies, music, business, politics, and religion. In every conceivable space, capitalism, individual liberty, patriotism, nationalism, and religion are under attack. Zero reality on race. I used to stop in at a coffee shop around the corner from my house and buy a cup of coffee for 50 cents. That was quite a few years ago. For two quarters, I got a hot cup of coffee, some friendly service, and maybe a newspaper left on the counter by the last customer. If I talked to the guy behind the counter, it was about the weather or some other small talk. Today, I walk into a Starbucks and pay $4 for a cup of coffee. Instead of a second-hand newspaper, I'm handed a questionnaire, seeking to determine just how much white privilege I'm guilty of. This is all done under the pretense of stimulating empathy and compassion for one another, but we all know that's nonsense. It's about reminding white people how evil they are. Consider the questions. I have blank friends of a different race. My parents had blank friends of a different race. In the past year, someone of a different race has been in my home blank times. Can you believe this? This is what it has come to. One of the most successful corporations in America peddling the most pedestrian, liberal, white guilt trash to its paying customers. Instead of working to develop new products or cut their exorbitant costs, they want to make white people feel guilty if they haven't had a person of a different race over to their house in the past year. For those suffering from acute liberalism, allow me to apply a therapy called reality. The reality is that 72% of Americans are Caucasian, 12% are African Americans, about 5% are Asians, and every other race comprises the final 10%. So, in your everyday interactions with people in this country, the odds are overwhelming that most of them are going to be Caucasian. Outside of large cosmopolitan cities, the odds that you will have the opportunity to strike up a friendship with someone of another race are quite low. This isn't something to feel guilty about. It isn't something to feel anything about. Most Nigerians don't have white people over to their houses on a regular basis. Most Inuit people will never have a Hispanic family over to their house. That's not because Nigerians or Inuit are racist. It's because there just aren't many white or Hispanic people around where they live. This may seem like common sense, but it's not as common as you think. Peddling white guilt is part of the liberal agenda, but a lot of liberals actually buy into it. They truly feel guilty themselves just for being who they are. Movies and television help create this irrational guilt by portraying American society in a completely fictional manner. Every television show whose cast includes a group of children portrays the group as not only multiracial and multicultural, but equally represented by every race and culture on the planet. No matter where the show takes place, you can expect every group of childhood friends to include a Caucasian child, a black child, a Hispanic child, an Asian child, and an Indian child. Despite the hard numbers that 7 in every 10 children are Caucasian, one would have to conclude from watching children's television shows that no group of childhood friends in this country includes 3 or more Caucasian children. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with showing children of different races playing together. What I do object to is portraying a false picture of American society, which contributes to the irrational guilt I was just talking about. If you are accepting of other people regardless of their skin color, you have nothing to feel guilty about, even if you don't have occasion to develop relationships with people of other races. These contrived plots in which there are virtually no all-white groups of children plant the seed in children that there is something wrong if they don't have friends of other races. Instead, children should learn that race doesn't matter. Character does. What are Western values post-Obama? Western civilization reached its apex in the United States of America, the freest, most prosperous, and most powerful nation in the history of the world. That civilization was built upon principles derived from English common law and tradition, Judeo-Christian morality, and the uniquely American principles of individualism and self-reliance. What are Western values today? Shooting junk at night and taking a coffee enema in the morning? Sleeping with 15 people at night and doing an herbal bath cleansing routine the next day? Are those our values now? Is this why everyone is into detoxing, because they know their souls are polluted? Here we are, 50 years after the 1960s, when we were told to eliminate all repression, to let it all hang out. If it feels good, do it. Why don't we do it in the road? Can anyone really say that has worked out well? We hear a lot about how repressed American society was before the 1960s, but not much about how much more well-ordered and civilized it might have been. John Adams famously said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people." He was right. There has always been a protection against any federal government-mandated religion in this country, as there should be. But religion or some equivalent moral set of principles is a responsibility that goes along with freedom. We can see the consequences of abandoning that responsibility all around us. Americans barely notice as a rogue president runs roughshod over the Constitution, takes over the health care system, floods the country with illegal aliens, and alienates our allies overseas. As long as the beer is flowing, football is available 3 nights a week, and porn is available 24/7, they'll stay fat, dumb, and happy. One would be hard-pressed to answer whether the United States is still a land of opportunity or a land of dependency. 1 in 8 Americans are receiving food stamp assistance. Over 1/3 of Americans have government-subsidized health insurance. We have 2 opposing forces fighting in the world right now. We have the extremely religious Muslim fanatics who interpret their religion from a 9th-century point of view and are willing to kill for it. They'll kill boys for watching soccer, believing that watching a soccer game is the first step on a slippery slope to becoming transgendered. That is how insane these fanatics are. The West is exactly the opposite. It has no values left. The left destroyed the church. They've destroyed all semblance of religion and morality. They've destroyed the American principles of private property, free enterprise, self-reliance, and personal responsibility. They've replaced them with atheism, hedonism, dependency, and political correctness. Man in the West today has no soul. The Islamofascists are using this to their advantage. While they're conquering Afghanistan and Iraq militarily, they're conquering America with propaganda. They are spreading disinformation through academia and the media, including Hollywood. They're smearing as racist anyone who stands up to radical Islam. They're using the same tactics against those who recognize the danger of Islamofascism as liberals used against McCarthy and others who recognized the dangers of communism 60 years ago. Even self-described feminist Dr. Phyllis Chesler, emerita professor of psychology and women's studies at the City University of New York, agrees with me on this. They'll even attack their own. When Bill Maher had a moment of clarity and hosted Sam Harris to talk about the real problems within Islam itself, the progressive jackals descended on both of them, calling them racists and Islamophobes. Ben Affleck, a guest on the same episode, nearly burst a blood vessel, calling Harris's arguments gross and racist. One blogger at the Huffington Post went so far as to level the ultimate slander at Maher, at least to the progressive mind. He called him conservative. What do we stand for, and what will we fight with? Our strength was built upon our values. When we were a moral and religious people, dedicated to individual liberty, personal responsibility, private property, and limited government, we were invincible. Those principles were the reason we had the mightiest economy and the most powerful military on earth. Now, those values are gone. They're all but extinct. The Islamofascists may be wrong, but they are dedicated to their creed and willing to die for it. We've abandoned our creed. What exactly are our soldiers supposed to die for today? I certainly wouldn't want to put my life on the line for a lot of what I see around me. I don't even know what to say to a soldier who comes home from Afghanistan after defending a society which curses his service and protests movies celebrating his heroism. Soldiers used to return from war to a society of high culture, innovation, and free enterprise, where institutions like private property, churches, and traditional marriage ensured a level of civility and prosperity that made their service worth the sacrifice and risk. Today, they return to an increasingly unrecognizable caricature of that bastion of freedom they thought they were defending. This is partly the result of Government Zero. When you have zero leadership, you can expect people to be led astray. But don't forget cause and effect. The government is largely a reflection of the people. The people elected it. The people decide what they want to ask it to do. Ultimately, it is the people who must take responsibility. The government can force them to buy health insurance, but not to abandon their values. Any reform of the government must be preceded by a rebirth of American culture. Only a moral and religious people, who once again dedicate themselves to American values, can find the strength to defeat America's enemies, both without and within. Chapter 7. Zero Immigration. What country is this? Obama has flooded America with Africans, Middle Easterners, and Chinese over the past 3 years. Europeans need not apply for citizenship. You can see now what he meant when he promised to transform America. While Mexicans remain the largest immigrant population in the United States, the progressive Islamist administration has managed to increase immigration from the Middle East, Asia, and the Caribbean the most. Overall, the number of immigrants living in the United States, legally and illegally, is at an all-time high of 41.3 million. It wasn't too long ago that America was still a first-world nation that led the world in commerce and military might. Despite decades of progressive assault, private property, free enterprise, Judeo-Christian values, and respect for law and order still dominated American culture. English was the first and only language, and immigrants enthusiastically learned to read, write, and speak it in an attempt to become Americans. Upon these pillars was built the freest, richest, most powerful nation in human history. Today, the entire foundation of American society is under assault by a progressive Islamist alliance that hasn't neglected reshaping our entire immigration policy. We're no longer a land of opportunity for ambitious, talented immigrants looking to escape social democracies with large welfare states. We're now a land of government handouts for waves of immigrants, both legal and illegal, who come here for the generous welfare benefits our progressive government keeps increasing. We're also a target for Islamofascists who are actively infiltrating our free and open society for the express purpose of destroying American civilization. Turkey's former prime minister and now president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, once said, "We will ride the train of democracy to our ultimate goal," meaning a new caliphate based upon Sharia law. He was talking about Turkey. The Islamofascists want to ride our American democratic train to the same goal here. What they don't blow up, they could eventually rule by voting. Look at what the immigration policies of just a few decades have done. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, Hispanics made up 8.9% of the electorate as of November 2012. We have to assume that number is even higher now. Immigrants in general, including these, largely vote Democrat. Unlike previous waves of immigrants, the current wave coming from south of our border doesn't consider learning English or assimilating into American culture a responsibility that goes along with immigrating. They have demanded and received accommodations in their own language. Today, Americans have to press one for English if they want service in the language in which their constitution is written. Some of them even consider their immigration here a reconquista, meaning they are reclaiming the land which once belonged to their Spanish-speaking ancestors. Regardless of what you might think of their claims, they are open and honest about one thing. They aren't looking to assimilate into American culture. They are looking to assimilate the territory they settle into Mexican or Spanish culture. Language is only the tip of the iceberg. Along with language, we're importing people with different political ideas. They come from largely socialist countries and are unlike previous waves of immigrants in that they don't necessarily come to get away from socialism. On the contrary, their voting patterns suggest they are attracted to the more generous welfare benefits than are available at home. Instead of escaping socialist countries and oppressive governments to take advantage of free enterprise and individual liberty here, they are coming here to transform America into the image of the countries they left and plunder the accumulated wealth of America's freer past. How else could one explain their uniform support for the Democratic Party? The other half of the progressive Islamic takeover is occurring through the federal government's refugee resettlement program. Admitting largely Muslim refugees from war-torn and terrorism-plagued countries in the Middle East, the progressives are creating self-contained Muslim communities in virtually every state. These groups of refugees are riddled with terrorists that even the FBI says they cannot screen out. Those who aren't violent nevertheless represent a completely foreign culture that in no way shares our values. This is all the result of legal immigration, assuming there is still any distinction between legal and illegal. Illegal immigrants are having an even worse effect. At best, they are illiterate in their own language and have grim prospects for employment. At worst, they are hardened criminals or terrorists themselves who are a grave threat to public safety. Those of us who remember the America of not so long ago wake up every day and ask, "What country is this?" Those of you who don't will nevertheless ask the same question just a few years from now, unless the progressive Islamist takeover is stopped. Sleeper cells among us. While illegal immigrants continue to pour over our southern borders, carrying potentially deadly diseases, socialist values, and no discernible benefit to American society, the progressives in control of the White House are also importing 100,000 Muslims per year as refugees. Under the pretense of humanitarianism, these useless academics are creating the very sleeper cells FBI counterterrorism chief Michael Steinbach says now exist in 49 states. The White House sorority, and the useful idiots who parrot them, constantly downplay the threat of radical Islam by saying there is no way for Islamofascist armies like ISIS to breach our borders. "It's not like we're going to wake up one day and find ISIS in New York," they sneer. They referred to the farcical prospect of ISIS invading the United States in a conventional military operation. They're right about one thing. ISIS won't have to wait for the progressives to weaken our military to that extent. ISIS is already here. But they didn't land Normandy-style in amphibious landing craft. They were brought in by our government as refugees and secretly resettled all over America. Earlier this year, Representative Trey Gowdy, Republican, South Carolina, sent John Kerry a letter. He wanted more information about the dozens of foreign refugees from Syria, North Africa, and elsewhere coming into South Carolina. It was the first time I know of that a congressman actually called the federal government to account for its unilateral decisions while bringing in 70,000 refugees a year on average over the past few years. Congressman Gowdy asked all the questions one would expect from a conscientious representative of his constituents. Who in Congress or the state and local governments were consulted before the decision was made to resettle these people in Spartanburg, South Carolina? What services will taxpayers be obliged to provide these refugees? How many have criminal records? How many more are coming? As glad as I was to see somebody in Congress actually pushing back, there are a few questions I'd like to ask Mr. Kerry myself. First, why is the administration granting asylum mostly to Muslims from Syria, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq when a full-fledged Holocaust is being perpetrated against Christians? Second, how do we know that ISIS agents posing as refugees are not among those the administration has admitted and put on a fast track to citizenship, just as the FBI has warned? I know the answer to my first question, although I wouldn't expect the Islamophilic administration to answer it. Bringing in Muslims, even legitimate refugees, is consistent with the progressive Islamist takeover of America. These ready-made communities are just more pockets of anti-American, unassimilated foreigners who will eventually become citizens and vote Democrat. They further dilute Christianity as the dominant religion in America, English as the dominant language, and American values as the dominant culture. As far as my second question, the FBI has already told us they aren't screening refugees for links to terrorism. As WorldNet Daily reported, the U.S. simply does not have the resources to stop Islamic radicals in Syria from slipping into the country through the State Department's Refugee Resettlement Program, said Michael Steinbach, Deputy Assistant Director of the FBI's Counterterrorism Unit. Leaving Christians to the Wolves. While we know the progressives want to do anything but bring more Christians into America, it is unconscionable that they would allow their political agenda to deter them from taking immediate, emergent action to address the genocide of Christians in the Middle East. While the Muslim-in-chief refuses to say the word Islamic when referring to the Islamic State, that very group is systematically exterminating the most ancient population of Christians in the world. You wouldn't know this from listening to the president. Just like the Jews murdered by Islamic terrorists in a kosher Jewish deli in Paris became merely some folks randomly murdered by zealots, the 147 Christians murdered by Islamic terrorists were nondescript, innocent men and women murdered by terrorists. There isn't any doubt that these were Muslims targeting Christians. They were members of the Somali-based Al-Shabaab terror group, and they specifically asked the victims if they were Christian or Muslim before murdering them. Christians attempting to impersonate Muslims to save their lives were asked to recite a Muslim prayer. If they could not, they were killed. Similarly, Obama referred to the 21 Coptic Christians beheaded by Islamofascists in Libya merely as Egyptian citizens. Yet, when ISIS kills Muslims they believe aren't practicing the faith properly in their insane opinion, Obama openly recognizes the religious identity of the victims, as he did Ismailis and Alawites in Syria. The president is always quick to remind us that ISIS has killed more Muslims than members of any other religion. He truly has a keen eye for the obvious. Most people in the region are Muslims, so it isn't surprising ISIS has killed more Muslims overall than Christians. The difference is that Muslims are not targeted because they are Muslim. On the contrary, demonstration of one's dedication to Orthodox Islam can save one's life and property in territories under ISIS control. Christians, on the other hand, are without exception dispossessed and exiled, if they're lucky, or summarily executed, if they're not. The president knows all of this, But he and the sorority have made up their minds to pretend the extermination of Christians isn't happening. That makes it a certainty Christians can expect little help from U.S. immigration as long as the progressives control the White House. Believe it or not, this is exactly what the so-called bleeding heart liberals did during the original Holocaust. Their patron saint, the great man of the people, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the Democratic Congress were in a similar position to help Jews during the 1930s. But despite repeated pleas to increase the quota for German immigrants, the Democrats failed to do so. As Kristallnacht and Auschwitz loomed, FDR's government kept the limit on German immigration at just over 27,000 immigrants per year. They failed to significantly raise the limit even after Jews were declared non-citizens in 1935. From late 1938 through June 1939, over 300,000 German refugees applied for visas, but most were unsuccessful. Even after the Holocaust was underway, the progressive FDR administration refused to believe the truth about it, although admittedly less deliberately than Obama appears to be denying the new Holocaust. Worst of all, the FDR administration didn't even admit all of the Jews the quotas would have allowed. Between 1933 and 1937, only 30,000 refugees entered the United States. The quotas would have allowed almost 130,000. That means FDR could have admitted 100,000 more Jews without even fighting the political battle to have quotas raised, but he didn't. You'll never believe the reason given for not admitting more Jews fleeing the Holocaust. They were afraid the refugees would be a burden on the welfare system. Can you believe that, coming from the Democrats? The same people who want to bring in tens of millions who can't read or write in their own language were suddenly afraid that Jews fleeing the Holocaust would be a burden on taxpayers. It would be funny if it weren't so tragic. So much for the great defenders of the oppressed. If you're African, Muslim, or socialist, progressives will spare no expense to defend you against the slightest infringement of your rights. But if you're Jewish, Christian, or capitalist, they will look the other way, even in the face of mass murder. They protested every war the United States fought against communism, but actively supported Clinton's intervention in Kosovo. Why? Because Clinton took the side of the Muslims against the Christian Serbians. Suddenly, the peaceniks were war hawks. Now, they are silent, while Christians are slaughtered, just as they were during the Nazi Holocaust. The women's rights activists who invent rape culture on college campuses and in the military have nothing to say about ISIS kidnapping 10-year-old girls and forcing them to get married. They say nothing about Yazidi girls abducted and turned into sex slaves for ISIS soldiers. Where is their outrage? One has to wonder what could be in the minds of this administration, other than direct harm to the American people. Forget the lack of compassion for Christian refugees of this new Holocaust. What possible benefit could the American people derive from bringing in 100,000 Muslims every year? Given a finite total number of refugees who can be accommodated, what possible reasoning would lead any sane person to choose Muslims over Christians? He is bringing Shia-Sunni internecine warfare into America. It's like bringing viruses and bacteria into a healthy population. The sleepers awaken. As I've said many times about this administration, it doesn't matter whether they are playing for the other side or just clueless academics in over their heads. Either way, the results for the American people are the same. These progressives are a clear and present danger to the American people every day they remain in office. We can't necessarily just wait out Obama's term either. Hillary Clinton certainly isn't talking about doing anything different. Picking up right where Obama will have left off, she's talking about LGBT activism, income inequality, and global warming. As I've discussed in other chapters, she's been friendly with the Muslim world for decades. We don't have time to wait for the right party to get elected. Without a serious opposition party, it may not matter who wins the next election. Besides, the sleeper cells have already started to wake from their slumber. In April, Abdirahman Sheikh Mohammed was arrested for plotting to attack police or military personnel after returning from ISIS training in Syria. The initial reports sounded like something Obama's sorority had scripted for his latest press conference. Muhammad was initially described as an Ohio man and a U.S. citizen. You might have thought this was just an average local boy who fell in with the wrong crowd and was led astray. In reality, Muhammad was a Somalian immigrant who was already plotting to commit terrorism within the United States when he became a U.S. citizen in 2014. His communications with his brother indicate that becoming a citizen was all part of the plot to become an ISIS agent within our borders. How did this man become a U.S. citizen? Where was DHS, TSA, and the rest of the security apparatus our billions fund? How does an immigrant from Somalia get through the process to become a citizen and receive a U.S. passport, while NSA is intercepting the phone and email metadata on every man, woman, and child in this country? Could it be they aren't looking for Somalian terrorists? Are they spending too much time targeting conservatives for tax audits? Whatever the explanation, ISIS is laughing at us. Just think about this. If Muhammad hadn't been caught after returning from Syria, he would have been able to vote in the next election. How many more like him are out there? Muhammad wasn't the first Somali immigrant to attempt this. Just a few days after his arrest, six men from the Somali immigrant community in Minnesota were arrested for attempting to travel to Syria to join ISIS. And these six weren't the first from this community. Late last year, two other men attempted to travel to Syria to join ISIS from the same Somali community. One of them was successful. Over the past 8 years, at least 22 people from Little Mogadishu, as this Somali community in Minnesota is called, have left the United States to join the Islamofascists overseas. Some have gone back to Somalia to join Al-Shabaab. Some have joined the rebels the White House sorority is funding in Syria against the Assad regime. Wherever they end up, they join the war against civilization being waged by Islamists on a global scale. This isn't an isolated incident. Little Mogadishu has just had more time to develop into a full-blown terror cell. The government has an ongoing refugee resettlement program that has resettled Somali refugees in Columbus, Ohio, San Diego, California, and Lewiston, Maine. By the way, these cities were picked at least partly because of their generous welfare programs. I'm sure you're happy to hear you're funding this terrorist recruiting program. I do not mean to imply the program is limited to these few states. The network of federal, state, and private agencies is able to resettle refugees in all 50 states. Once you understand what is going on, the threat of terror cells in every state doesn't sound at all crazy. On the contrary, it's crazy to ignore what's happening before our very eyes. From listening to our Soviet-style media, one could assume our biggest challenge was to ensure Muslim Americans weren't discriminated against. I'm not saying some innocent Muslims aren't unfairly assumed to be violent in some cases. What I am saying is we have far more serious problems to worry about. We have an administration which is, intentionally or not, rolling out the red carpet for people who have not only sworn to kill all of us, but to enslave the entire world. They can only succeed with a compliant government that puts its own needs above those of its people. Importing crime. Not every crime committed by an immigrant or illegal alien is an act of terrorism. Some are just ordinary crimes committed by garden variety criminals, who likewise should not have been admitted into the United States. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, is charged with making the removal of illegal immigrants who have criminal records a priority. On its website, DHS reported it conducted a total of 577,295 removals and returns, including 414,481 removals and 162,814 returns during fiscal year 2014. That sounds like an impressive number, until you dig a little deeper. That's when you start hearing about the results of Obama's prosecutorial discretion in dealing with his so-called dreamers. In a report DHS provided to Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, illegal aliens with criminal records released by DHS committed 1,000 crimes in 2013. These crimes included child sex abuse, carjacking, aggravated assault, and a host of others. Those are just numbers for 2013. A separate report based upon Judicial Watch's analysis of 76 DHS documents concluded that almost 166,000 illegal aliens with criminal records were released back into American society as of April 2014. America learned how tragically this can end when 31-year-old Kate Steinle was shot to death by an illegal immigrant who had previously been deported 5 times. Not only had Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez been deported 5 times before the shooting, he had 7 prior felony convictions. Sanchez was on an American street because San Francisco is a sanctuary city, meaning its government does not cooperate fully with federal immigration authorities. Sanchez had been turned over to San Francisco deputies pursuant to a drug warrant by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, with a request that they be notified if Sanchez were released. This routine request is called an immigration detainer and would have been honored by law enforcement elsewhere. It was not honored by San Francisco law enforcement because of the sanctuary city policy. This was by no means the first time the policy has resulted in tragedy. In 2008, Edwin Ramos, an illegal immigrant suspected of previous murders, shot and killed a 48-year-old man and his 2 sons. Ramos thought one of the sons was a rival gang member. Ramos had been twice protected by the city's sanctuary city policy after committing crimes as a minor. There couldn't be a better example of government zero than this. After letting the federal government run roughshod over the powers reserved to the states or the people, the one instance in which local governments push back is on an issue in which they actually should cooperate fully with the federal authorities. Had they done so this past July, Kate Steinle might still be alive today. It is not just intentional violence one has to worry about. Illegal aliens are convicted of drunk driving and driving without a license or insurance. So if you're involved in a traffic accident with an illegal immigrant, you have 0 chance of getting medical expenses or damages to your vehicle reimbursed, even if the accident was 100% the other driver's fault. Juan Perez Juarez managed to hit the trifecta. He managed a violent crime, indecent exposure, and a traffic accident involving injuries to another driver, all on the same day. It almost sounds like a joke, but it's not. The details are chilling. It all started when the illegal immigrant from Guatemala saw a little girl playing in front of her house in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. Perez Juarez first attempted to entice the little girl into his car. When she refused to get in, he got out of his car, exposed himself, and then urinated in the street. Fortunately, the child's father came out to chase Perez Juarez away. While making his escape, Perez Juarez crashed his car into a pole. He was later involved in a 2nd accident involving injuries to the other driver and was finally arrested. All of this mayhem was caused by one criminal, illegal alien released by the Obama administration. Just imagine Perez Juarez's Saturday afternoon multiplied by 166,000. This is the kind of chaos the progressives are creating in a society where violent crime rates had previously been cut in half over the past 20 years. Just as they are destroying the world order with their progressive Islamist foreign policy, they're destroying civil society from within with their insane immigration policies. Johnny Alberto Enamorado Vasquez was apprehended immediately after entering the country illegally in October 2012. He spent several weeks being passed around by several federal agencies, including ICE and the Department of Health and Human Services. He was released later that month due to lack of space, according to the government. 2 years later, Enamorado was charged with the January 2015 murder of Michael Phelan, a Houston smoke shop owner. Enamorado and 2 accomplices allegedly broke into the shop and killed Phelan in a gunfight. It goes without saying that crimes like this are perpetrated by natural-born American citizens every day. I'm not claiming people who were born here don't have the same dark side of their natures as people everywhere. I am saying that American culture has traditionally been freer, more peaceful, and more law-abiding than many of the countries illegal immigrants are coming from. Even within those countries, the law-abiding people who want to emigrate obey the law and apply through the proper channels. Those who sneak in illegally have already demonstrated a lack of respect for the law. We shouldn't be surprised when they break other laws once here. The government is never going to keep every criminal out of American society, but it should at least be trying to the best of its ability. Had Johnny Alberto and Amorato Vasquez not been carelessly released in 2012, Michael Phelan would still be alive today. Importing disease. I've been warning about the danger of deadly diseases carried by illegal immigrants for over 30 years. I wrote a book on the subject called Immigrants and Epidemics in 1981, but I could not get it published, even though all of my previous books had sold. Why? I was told by every publisher that a book on that subject was off limits, regardless of how well documented or factually accurate. They were all afraid to publish it for political reasons. Now, the socialist dictator Obama has decided that elections don't matter and has used his phone and pen to rewrite immigration law himself. Besides being unconstitutional, he's risking an epidemic in America due to the diseases many of the illegals are bringing in. As far as I'm concerned, he committed a crime against humanity in dumping many ill people on us, primarily mothers and children, in the summer of 2014. Many of them brought in measles, tuberculosis, and other illnesses. These kids came in from countries where those diseases are endemic. This is one of the chief reasons we have immigration laws in the first place. At Ellis Island, when America was run by men who wanted to protect the population rather than infect it, people who looked sick or were not vaccinated were sent back to their country of origin. Sometimes they were vaccinated and kept in quarantine before being allowed to enter the general population. This was not a denial of their right to immigrate. It was an enforcement of their responsibility not to start an epidemic when exercising that right. It was protecting the right of the existing population not to be infected by diseased immigrants. That's one of the main reasons we have immigration laws. Obama and his stooges at the CDC have covered up what has already been a crisis in new or previously eradicated diseases brought in by illegal immigrants. Tuberculosis, hand, foot, and mouth disease, and Chagas disease, previously eradicated from Southern California, are all on the rise and testing positive in Border Patrol agents. The vice president of the Border Patrol Union, Chris Cabrera, confirmed this to Fox News in July 2014. Our agents don't like to see these kids in these conditions, especially coming off the long journey they have been subjected to, and then the diseases that some of our agents are contracting. We had one get bacterial pneumonia a couple days ago, Cabrera said. A lot of our guys are coming down with scabies or lice. He added, the Border Patrol is trying to play catch-up, and we're having a lot of diseases coming in and some we haven't seen in decades, and we are worried they'll spread throughout the United States, especially if they, the immigrants, are being released and have the disease. Not only has the Obama sorority allowed thousands of sick immigrants to enter the country, it has then transported them all over the United States, over the objections of immigration professionals who are trying to do their jobs and contain any threat of contagious disease. Even ABC News reported on this. They also interviewed Cabrera. We are sending people everywhere. The average person doesn't know what's going on down here, said Border Patrol agent and Rio Grande Valley Union representative Chris Cabrera. Cabrera says agents are seeing illegal immigrants come over with contagious infections. Whoever has permitted this, whether it was the stooge at the CDC, the stooge at the NIH, or Obama himself, is at least guilty of criminal negligence. Where are all the shyster lawyers who sue doctors for negligence when they make an honest mistake? They send their kids to college with money they made suing doctors, but they're nowhere to be found when the government is negligent and endangers us all. One of the reasons health departments are overwhelmed is a huge spike in tuberculosis cases over the past 2 years. It isn't an isolated incident. Forget what the Department of Health and Human Socialism tells you. Tuberculosis has broken out at camps for illegal immigrant children at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas and Fort Sill in Oklahoma, as Fox News reported last July. However, at least a half dozen anonymous sources, including nurses and healthcare providers who worked at Lackland, allege that the government is covering up what they believe to be a very serious health threat. Several of my sources tell me that tuberculosis has become a dangerous issue at both the border and the camps. The amount of tuberculosis is astonishing, one healthcare provider told me. The nurses are telling us the kids are really sick. The tuberculosis is definitely there. I'll bet your local paper neglected to report that, too. Why would they? It might make dear leader Obama look bad. It might make it look like keeping his oath and doing his constitutional duty was probably a good idea after all. Don't expect to hear anything that contradicts the dictator from Pravda or Izvestia. Outbreaks of the rare Enterovirus 68, EVD68, are also suddenly occurring all over the country, in areas as remote from the southern border as Missouri, Illinois, and Buffalo, New York. Why is this suddenly happening all over the country? It couldn't be because Obama is putting sick illegal immigrants on buses and airplanes and transporting them all over the country, could it? No, Savage, that's crazy talk. Nothing dear leader does could possibly be so harmful. It isn't just measles or the flu. Children have actually been crippled. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, itself, was investigating whether the virus was causing symptoms similar to polio in at least 9 infected children in September 2014. One would think that, with all of this, the federal department whose sole reason to exist is to control and prevent disease outbreaks would be highly concerned. One might expect the CDC to issue the strongest recommendations to the president to take emergency steps to protect the public, his first duty as president. Instead, the CDC claims it has no idea about the origin of these diseases. In a February 2015 update to its investigation on EVD68, causing polio-like symptoms in children, the CDC reported it was now referring to the condition as acute flaccid myelitis and had verified cases of 112 children in 34 states who had developed the condition. The section titled, "What CDC is Doing," listed several bullet points on actions taken by the agency, including further testing, working with healthcare professionals and state and local departments of health, and so on. What the update makes no mention of is any effort to determine the reason these outbreaks suddenly occurred all over the United States, immediately following Obama's new immigration initiatives. The agency had said in its initial report in September it had particular interest in characterizing the epidemiology and etiology of such cases. Apparently, it lost interest in the epidemiological aspect of the investigation. I wonder why. Is there some reason they suddenly don't want to know the origin of these diseases? It has previously denied any link between illegal immigrant children and the virus, despite a peer-reviewed report linking EVD68 to Latin American children. Now it isn't investigating the origin of the disease at all, even though it has previously published a study on its own website calling EVD68 one of the most rarely reported serotypes, with only 26 reports throughout the 36-year study period. Almost 5 times